Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. And this week I'm rejoined by an old regular. David, how are you?
I'm quite well, thank you. And yourself?
Terrific. David Sprentice, you've been incredibly busy, but you've got a weekend off and you've decided to share it with us, and we really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Oh, no worries.
And why don't you introduce our third guest host this week?
He's a good friend of yours and commercial director from down there, down under, Mr. Jason Wingrove.
Hey, guys. Hey, Dave.
And this week we've decided to cover which film, David?
That would be Ghostbusters from 1984.
Now, we decided to pick Ghostbusters in part because it was a good film. We did cover Close Encounters last week, but we wanted to actually pick up on something we didn't get to talk about last week, and that was really this whole age before digital. Because if you were to map out the evolution of visual effects, it actually turned digital pretty much right between when Ghostbusters 1 was done and when Ghostbusters 2 was done. In fact, I had a great quote from the visual effects supervisor off this film, who said that they expected the move between analog and digital to be a fade, and it turned out to being a hard cut. And what we wanted to discuss was this age of optical and mechanical effects, which not only is embodied in this film, but also by Boss Films, which was the production or the post-production company that did the visual effects on this, formed for Ghostbusters and then actually finished almost exactly 10 years ago, maybe 11 years ago. And Jason, this is an area or a particular era of filmmaking that you've got a particular fondness for, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I was going through film school around about this time, and I don't know, I think special effects is probably, I've really got a soft spot for that, probably even more than any other part of filmmaking for some reason. It's, this is a real golden age for me.
Well, the light is green and the trap is clean. So, David, do you want to give us your impressions of the film overall?
This is one of the funniest films, I think, of all time. It's one of my personal favorites. And as a visual effects film, it's weird because you always think of visual effects films as these big action movies or adventure movies, and you tend to think of Ghostbusters as a comedy first, but it is a tour de force of old school effects. I mean, you have on-set mechanicals, you have opticals, you have cloud tanks, you have stop motion, you have pretty much everything that was available at the time thrown at you, and it's fantastic, and to a certain extent really still holds up today. At least it gets the story points across without being too distracting, which is still a great thing to see.
Well, Jason, the visual effects supervisor, Richard Edlund, who I quoted earlier, also said that they were very serious about making it stupid. How well do you think the film succeeded in seriously making it stupid?
I think it's succeeded fantastically at being stupid. I mean, even the effects, the guys themselves, even now, would admit that the effects are, cartoony and just a bit of fun and not the be-all and end-all of the film. It's they know that those effects aren't holding up all that well, and even back then it was quite a simple, even a low budget film back then, and it's
Well, let's discuss the budget for a second. Apparently, what happened is that this film evolved very, very quickly. Quite literally, Dan Aykroyd wrote a 40-page treatment. Initially, it was going to have himself and his comic partner Belushi in it, but in the end that treatment didn't obviously evolve Belushi because he died, and Harold Ramis got involved in writing it, but Ivan Reichman, who directed it, took the actual treatment, which even wasn't a script at this stage, to I think it was Columbia, was it, David? I think Columbia Pictures.
Yes, Columbia Producers.
And apparently said, oh, this is a film we want to make, and they were like, brilliant, sounds really funny. As long as you can make it in exactly 12 months, i.e. to hit the summer release, June, 12 months when they were talking, how much do you reckon it would cost? And apparently Ivan Reichman took the number out of the air, which was literally three times his last budget, which was $30 million, and they came in at $31 million. And the budget for the visual effects then, by my research, clocked in at about $6.5 million. But what was interesting, and I don't know if you guys heard any of this, but apparently the original script they've joked that if they tried doing Dan Aykroyd's original script, it would have cost, you know, the full $30 million, because it had like the Powderpuff guy coming out of the East River. There were just, you know, enormous amounts of effect. In fact, the entire film was set in the future, where there were a whole lot of Ghostbusters, and we just happened to be following one set of janitor-type Ghostbusters who were going about their business. It wasn't the starting up a business film that that certainly Harold Ramis contributed to. So I guess the question is, when you first saw this, Jason, did you sort of at the time seem like the effects were really believable and spectacular? Because obviously with today's, you know, history, looking back some 20-odd years, it's pretty obvious some of the cloud tank stuff's a bit wonky.
Yeah, I don't remember the effects being bad at all. I think you just get totally transported in. I think when you actually look back at it, there's actually not lots and lots of effects in it. It's about an hour and a half in before you actually really start to get that first entrapment at the hotel. It's, you know, and there's a lot of film, there's a lot of setup, there's a lot of very sort of simple little sporadic little effects just sort of teasing you as you go along. So it's more a comedy than an effects film.
Well, David, let's start with the positive. If you were to say one thing that worked really well and you think still works well in terms of visual effects, what would it be?
I still think that the proton packs work well. I mean, I'm a big fan of that hand-drawn, organic lightning effect that you see in a lot of, you know, I still think the lightning back on, you know, the Emperor's hands from Return of the Jedi looks better than the modern stuff, which is a good comparison between the two. I think the proton packs work really well. I think all the matte paintings, of course, still work really quite well. And the thing I love most in the whole movie is the design of the gargoyles at the end. Even though the stop motion I don't think really holds up compared to our level of believability that we're used to from our digital creatures these days. But and I still think, you look at the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, you know, it's still completely over the top and silly. You know, it is a 100-foot-tall marshmallow. But It works, you know. So I don't think there's anything in the movie that I would say doesn't really hold up compared to, you know, taking it in context. I think that's an important thing to do with any movie. But I would say if one effect I had to choose, it would have to be the proton pack effect.
What about you, Jason?
Yeah, you've picked my two as well, the neutrino wands or whatever they are. That's fantastic. That's such a... Looking at it again, I'm just amazed at how good that looks. It's such a mix of, you know, like pyro and effects and animation. I don't know what it is, but it just... You're not conscious of it being an effect. It just works so well.
Who as a kid didn't want one of those things?
Yeah.
So what about some of the other things that David mentioned?
Again, Mr. Stay Puft, that is just an awesome sequence. Everything about it looks really real. The scales are right, and the shooting speed and everything looks right. He just looks massive. There was, I think one of the extras I saw was this, there's a fantastic sort of shot looking down as Mr. Stay Puft's sort of marauding the streets, and there's this cop car hits this a fire hydrant, and this jet of water comes up. And it's actually, all of that is all miniature and it's real. They're firing out fine white sand in slow-mo, and it just looks... I looked at it again after I heard the comment, and it just looks so wonderful. Every little element, they just really... I think that was really done with love, that sequence.
I have a fun fact on that. They built the suit, and it was all going fine until someone actually worked out the scale that they'd worked it out at, and then managed to work it out at a 1/18th scale, which actually, as it so happened, was an incredibly impossible scale to find any actual cars that you could buy. And they needed a bunch of cars for the street. They actually found one type of car at Toys R Us, and they basically bought from every store they could find in the area, like 100 stores, to get enough cars so they could then repaint so that those cars you were talking about could actually be shop-bought ones that they were either pushing or radio-controlled, as opposed to having to make them from scratch. But you're right, that the marshmallow guy, I think, is really good. And I didn't pick any of the force perspective that was used in those shots. I mean, obviously there was compositing as well, but the force perspective. And I kind of think, David, don't you, that we've kind of missed something by not using force perspective these days?
I do too. It's still used occasionally, but rarely. It's I like it because it's cheap and it's immediate and it's in camera. So, you know immediately whether or not it's working. And, There's so much about the film that you can look back with nostalgia and like, oh, why don't we do it like this anymore? Because a lot of it still does work. But You know, when you're talking about the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, it got me thinking. You know, it's a guy in a suit, which you know, these days we probably would do, yeah, you know, some digital character that you'd have, you know, 6 or 7 animators working on, and then they'd go and they'd take it to this overly elaborate sequence where the, you know, the character's all acting out, when it's a giant marshmallow who's just, you know, marching and smashing, and it works better that way than I think if it was like some elaborate character who had any kind of personality or what have you, even though he does have a little bit of a personality when he gives that little malevolent smile.
Yeah, he comes across as this really dumb sort of marauding creature that's really just been brought into reality by someone's a quick thought in the back of someone's mind brings him into reality. So it's kind of like, I kind of like that he's kind of really simple and he's only got a couple of expressions and he's just been turned into this marauding thing without him even knowing it.
Now, be honest, did you pick up that Sigourney actually had Stay Puft Marshmallows when she had the eggs on the bench when the eggs were spontaneously frying themselves?
Very good.
I didn't catch that the first time, but I did catch that when I saw it on home video, yeah.
I guess for me, we don't have Stay Puft here, so it's an unusual brand that... it is actually a real brand, isn't it?
Is it a real brand? I don't know.
No, I don't think it... I've never actually seen them.
Oh, I think it was...
I think they had it tied into someone else, and then they had to not do it for, you know, not to get sued.
Yeah.
But well, it would be like, you know, as if you had a... you know, a cereal called Commander Crunch. It's like everyone knows who you're talking about, but it's
we don't have Captain Crunch either. But hey, I know what you're talking about. Hey, so I think it was Dan Aykroyd that described the visual effects as a bit like putting smoke in a Coke bottle with a baseball bat. So let me ask you this: we're talking about this era now of before digital that Boss you know, entered on, because Richard Evelyn set up Boss Films based for this film, and he had an amazing team with him. In fact, one of the people, any number of the people actually went on to do amazing things. John Bruno did X-Men 3. The matte painting you mentioned earlier, Matthew Urich worked on that. So Matthew Urich, just amazing matte painter. So there really was a stunning team put together. But Boss Films did a bunch of other really good films as well, and I think it's kind of worth flagging some of the other films that they did, because while Ghostbusters was, of course, huge, they also did 2010, which I guess was less iconic, but things like Die Hard, which is when 88, that original Die Hard film with the entire, was it Nagatomi Tower?
Nagatomi Building.
Now that was a film Nagatomi for me Plaza. That I just was completely... I just thought it was awesome. And also, again, a film like this, very much done on the pre-digital age, and, you know, they did move into doing digital stuff, obviously, by the time True Lies came out. But around 94, when True Lies was coming out, that's when Digital Domain was being built and stuff, and then they went on to do other things before finishing, like Air Force One and Multiplicity, which was actually, I think, with... Howard Ramis, and Multiplicity being obviously very much a digital film.
Multiplicity was amazing.
But I think this period pre-digital is when Boss really nailed it. Now, when they closed their doors in about 97, they actually said that they're only doing about $20 million a year in revenue, and it just wasn't enough to run a mid-level facility like this. And at the time, a lot of people pointed to this as the death of the mid-level facilities. You either needed the 1,000-person mega shops, or you needed like small little boutique kind of places. But I mean, looking back at films like Ghostbusters and Die Hard, at the time I watched them, I was both in awe and it looked real. You know, they were very much based, I mean, LA and New York, but they were very much based in sort of real places with real stuff, with real baddies. And even when Ghostbusters did the ghost stuff, it was still, you know, they were meant to be driving around real streets kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, look, it was I think it's all still fantastic. There's a lot of stuff on their run list here that is just truly, it's amazing that you can do all these films and go out of business.
And yet, well, you have a couple of David.
Yeah, well, to me, the amazing thing when you look back at the films of those of that era, especially, you know, because they kind of, you know, through the 60s and 70s, pretty much forgot about special effects until Star Wars and you know, Close Encounters and you know, 2001 kind of brought them back. But that, you know, by this point in the timeline of visual effects, a lot of the techniques had been developed and perfected, and you had a lot of people with a lot of experience. So you're at the heyday of the analog or pre-digital effects era. And I think the thing that I love about this era is, you know, it's like the difference between listening to a vinyl record versus listening to a CD. You know, while the CD is a perfect reproduction of what the producer is trying to give you, there's more life and vitality to the vinyl. And I think with the analog effects, or, you know, where you're doing optical compositing and hand paints and all that kind of stuff, that there's a little bit more kind of happy accidents that can work your way in, and you can get away with working faster and freer with what you're dealing with, you know, that adds a little bit, you know, of life to the work.
I guess one of the problems is that, and I point to the James Bond series as a classic case of this, when they were doing the old school effects, they, you know, you knew you had a Mercedes on top of a cliff, and when the guy pushed the Mercedes off a cliff, there must have been somehow a Mercedes on the darn cliff for the guy to push off, right? You knew it, because that's how else would you do it? Sure, there were tricks of the trade, and sure, there was all sorts of fun stuff. I mean, no one expected there was a giant powder puff guy, but when things blew up, you blew up. When I don't know, you know, somebody jumps off a building with a fire hydrant hose wrapped around their waist, they had to have somebody actually jump, and somebody actually had to smash through glass. Now, when Bond got to I'm trying to remember which one it was. I think it was in it was the one where he is set in the northern ice castle thing. And I remember at some point he flies off, hits a giant wave, surfs the giant wave.
That's right.
And it had gone fully digital, and now I'd lost all connection because I knew he could do anything because it was just digital.
The rocket ice car, and then he wakeboards.
The wakeboarding, exactly.
I remember that one. It was the one where he had the gadgets and he slept with a couple different women.
Yeah, that would be the one.
That's the one.
And that ice gadget surfing the wave thing looked not real because it wasn't real. It was all digital. And at that point, who cared? It was just sort of... And then I think they realized that, and they obviously came back with the new Bond, which has obviously got that grittier feel that, you know, they're trying to be much more anchored in the real.
I think what sort of separates for me now new digital effects and the old world thing is maybe I don't know, somewhere along the line, if they stopped teaching physics in high school or something, somehow, because digital lets you do everything, they do everything. It's kind of like, just because you can doesn't mean you should. There's like a lot of physics going out the window that maybe when you were doing things for real and you're doing things in camera and you got to work out scale and you got to work out frame rates, somehow physics stayed more grounded.
But I used to really sit there and look at these films like Ghostbusters and say, how did they do that? And I believe that there was an inventive solution in the way that a magician, I don't think a magician actually makes the rabbit disappear, doesn't break the laws of physics, but they're very clever in doing it. If I'm watching a video of a magician, it's less interesting to me because, yeah, okay, they just cut and the rabbit was taken away. That's not that interesting.
Yeah.
And for me, that's a bit what happened with this age of when we left the age of now. I think we're getting back to it. I think today we're getting some really great, you know, Bourne Ultimatum and
absolutely, and the newer and Casino Royale and all the Bonds.
Yeah,
now.
No, totally.
Bonds,
and, but I definitely think that these guys were creatively solving problems that you knew had to be solved by someone in a real world. And if that was, you know, a super inventive trick that they came up with, now, the opening of Ghostbusters with the cards coming out of the drawers and the books flying across, we know these to be wire effects and really simple. But you know what? They worked.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, you know,
compressed air through a pipe. That's it, you know. Yeah. Nowadays, you'd go, oh, God, it'll take so long to reset. You know, let's do it all CGI cards. And then they'd do twice as many cards as they could, and they'd go out twice as fast as would be practical, and it would just be ridiculous. And you go, okay, and that's an effect.
And it would wind up costing three times as much.
Yeah, that's right. Rather than having what they would have done then, that film would have been all the producers and everybody else would have got off their chairs and actually picked up some cards. God forbid.
Yeah, I mean, Because nowadays, what you'd have to do is it's like, okay, well, we have these cards that are going to, you know, fly through the air. So you'd, you know, sit four nerds down in a room, you know, bless nerds, I'm one myself, but, you know, and they'd be writing some complex, you know, fabric simulation in Houdini that would simulate the cards falling, and then they'd run that for like 20 days running this complex simulation where they have to match move the actors in there so the cards would bounce off of them, and then they'd have to do a GI pass and an ambient occlusion pass and then composite it all together, and then it wouldn't look nearly as real as just throwing a bunch of cards in the air.
Yeah, but then you'd have an animator who wants to then make his mark out of the four nerds in the basement so he can go up one level from the basement. And he'd say, I know, I can do this and I can do that, and I'll have some bounce off the ceiling fan. And then before you know it, it's gone over the top.
What makes that shot is the way that the character, played so well by Bill Murray, is just getting the gunk on his fingers and trying to flick it off and gets it in his eye and wipes it on the books. And that's what makes the scene, yeah. I know, look, I think it's... there definitely is a problem when you become uncontrolled that you can do anything. And I think that, you know, these guys knew that what they were doing was hard, so they obviously did limit it. And, you know, there are bits I think really don't work at all.
Sure,
I actually think the claymation stuff looks really hokey.
Yeah.
And really kind of... I mean, I don't think that really holds up at all. My daughter would be kind of like looking at that weird... But, you know, other bits, quite frankly, you know, just having a couple of grips sticking their hands through the couch, grabbing Sigourney and running it into the... That was scary then, and it was, you know...
It is. It is a scary sequence.
And actually, there's another, like, non-effect effect in the movie, which is when Sig is floating over the bed, hovering over the bed, you know... It was just a practical effect, just like a magician would levitate their assistant on stage these days, have always done it. They just did it on stage, you know, with a back brace and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm sure, you know, it was uncomfortable and all that kind of stuff. So these days you'd probably, have a large blue screen bed that was there and all that kind of stuff to kind of support your actor, and then it would all be composited out, and you'd probably do some complicated 360 move with a digital set to, you know, they're really floating, I'm not a fan of all we can do these days, you know.
No, I agree. Just look at Spider-Man. I'm sorry. I come back to physics, things like that, where they just really just physics just goes out the window, and you just I think half the audience, industry or not, just you do disconnect. Well, and I don't think we're being old fuddy duddies about this.
I would actually lean forward in my chair on a shot like Sigourney lifting, going both that's cool, how do they do it, and intrigued. I would engage with the film because I was desperately intrigued to work out how they did it. Whereas, you're right, on something like the last Spider-Man 3, when they were going through the buildings, I went, you know what, I can't tell which way is up. Obviously, Spidey's going to come out. Just tell me when this scene's over and I'll pay attention again.
Yeah, exactly. When does the movie start again?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about when you're doing stuff in camera or practical on set is you know how long it's going to take because it's there, right? So if you were doing something like a digital, you know, flurry of cards floating into the air or you know, springing into the air and falling down, you know, if you go and you do it, you know, you may get a happy accident with like a card landing on the actor's face and then sliding down that you catch on film, or you know it's going to take 12 seconds for the shot. Whereas, you know, you may edit your film and then it only has 6 seconds, in the cut, yet you have to have the cards go up and fall all the way down in that 6 seconds. And that's where you get your fake physics, right? Because you have a story point which you need to have happen. In other words, you know, cards go up, cards fall down. And they have to fit it into that amount of time. So you kind of fudge with reality in order for your story point to get across. Whereas if you just, you know, friggin' did it on set, you'd know how long it takes.
So do you think there is that sort of lack of... sort of onset knowledge is that it's bringing on all of this sort
of lack
of
physics?
Before you
get to that, I just want to pick up on, just jump in for a second, because David makes an incredibly good point. Do you know they had their first test screening to 200 people 3 weeks after principal photography on this because they did effects in camera?
Wow.
They didn't have all the effects in, of course, but they had a lot of stuff because there was enough there to cut.
Yeah, well, 1 year, that's just utterly amazing. Pre, shoot, and post.
I didn't mean to cut you off there, but it is testament. Yeah. If you've actually got stuff in camera, you've got it, that's you can actually edit the darn stuff together.
That's right, and as David, you said, you know, you are cutting to the effects shot, you know when its beginning is and end is. You're not sort of, okay, we'll put this, you know, the 75 frame gap in here, and that's what you've got to work with because we've, you know, we've locked it and we've already mixed to that. So, you know, damn, well, gee, things are going to really, the physics aren't going to work right here, or this shot's too short, but oh, well, I've got to make it work because that's the gap they've given, rather than the editors physically working with something that, you know, a known visual given.
Now, to pick up on your point, sorry, go on.
And I think one of the other things that happens is, you know, this happens a lot when you work on an independent film set or like a really low budget thing. I worked on something recently where we had a piece of sugar glass in a door that got broken, and we had one piece of glass. That was it. You know, this was, you know, the guys didn't eat lunch for a week in order to be able to pay for this one stunt. So it was like you had to get it right. So what you did is you just made sure that everything was perfect before you went. And it's like if something had screwed up, you know, that would be bad. Actually, that had very similar thing had happened to a friend of mine. They had one piece of breakaway glass and they shot it and everything went perfect. And then a certain camera named after a color, the data was corrupted on the CF card. So, nice. You know, that they lost their shot, but
those blue cameras suck.
Yeah, totally. Although I hear the Indigo, the new one coming out next year, awesome.
I'm waiting for Violet. But here's the thing, Jason was saying before, is it because people don't know on set? And I say it's not. I say it's this: we have got to a culture where it's keep the options open as long as possible. And so while you could commit on set, no one wants to commit on set because there's no imperative to commit on set, so everything's left to post. And I think that's a problem. I think that you need to occasionally just bite the bullet and say, you know what, I have the coverage, I have the shot, this is what I want, I'm going with it. And if they could commit to stuff on set, but you know, this whole idea of keeping your options open in case later you want to completely redo it, to the point of having actors where you're going to replace their arms and stuff because you want them holding onto other actors and different takes and mixing it up that much. I don't know. I don't know that necessarily makes for better films. It just makes for more expensive, longer films.
I mean, as a director, the whole thing of like doing, if I was option of hanging minute chair or force perspective versus doing something in effects, I'd say let's do it in effects.
Well,
because, and I'm
that.
Going totally contradicting myself here, but I would go with that way because I know, look, if it's not right, I can get it better. You know, I don't want to be conscious of that of effect if the lighting's not right or there's something about not right or the depth of field wasn't right and. Then it's that locked in thing.
And yet I'd say that the matte paintings by Michelle Moon and the other matte painters on this were brilliant. I mean, let's face it, a lot of these people joined Boss
fantastic.
Films were ex-ILM. They'd done Poltergeist, they'd done a bunch of stuff together. And that was an absolutely crack team. Having said that, I agree with you. But if looking at these matte paintings today, like, I thought they were magnificent.
Yeah, look, I don't think there was any issues with any of that sort of stuff. My main, if I was going to jump into the what I didn't think worked, is the end, top of the building scene, not from any other point of view, that the fact that the background is a painting.
It looked like a set, didn't it?
It is always, when you see the close-ups of the actors, you can tell just I don't know, subconsciously, even if you have no idea about
it, just looked like
about light or physics, the background is not out of focus.
I never
enough.
Believed that they're on top of a building, exposed to the elements. It
and when the
like
camera moves
were.
Around, they do a lot of crane moves in there, around in that building, and you can really just tell the way the background moves.
Now,
it's
top
just
of the
not far away.
Tower, when the helicopter explodes and stuff, I believe that was there. I believe.
Because it was probably, I don't know, that was all miniature and the big pyro.
I liked the pyro in this. What did you think, David, of that actual explosion, which obviously would have killed them, but that was the joke at the end of Ghostbusters?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it totally looked like they filmed it on a set, but then again, you look at, oh, I don't know, the last Indiana Jones movie, and half the things in that looked like they were shot on a soundstage.
Oh,
but one last thing I'd like to say before we really move on, and pyro, real pyro, when you're actually blowing stuff up, is always awesome. But the other thing about doing stuff on set, which I think, you know, is sometimes ignored, is what it gives the actors, and how it aids them in their performance. Because, you know, you stick an actor, I don't care who you stick, on a pure blue screen set, and they're going to have issues trying to really come up with a good performance, but you give them something real, something tactile that they can react to, and you're going to be much better off.
And you know, that is such a good point, actually. That you make an excellent point there. I remember hearing, someone was talking about Bill Murray, and you know, he walks into Sigourney's flat for the first time, and he has this weird thing that he's like a probe he's walking around with. And apparently he made a whole lot of them and just put them on a table and said, you know, which one should you use? And he picked the one that he thought had the most comic value and then proceeded to use it in the most comical way. And he improvised a lot of that scene, as did, a bunch of the other actors in their scenes.
Are you using that thing properly?
Well,
I think so.
I think so.
But I mean, the shot improvise. You talked about earlier, you know, when Sig is sitting in the chair and the arms come out and grab her, you know, it was grips or stunt players or someone who is, you know, stuck behind that chair in a very uncomfortable position, reaching out and grabbing her. And the way she reacted to that is going to be a whole lot more plausible than if the director said, okay, now I want you to scream and squirm and we'll add the hands in later.
Exactly.
It's like, you know, you would have the hands would probably form out of dust or particles or, you know, and be on fire or whatever, but it wouldn't, her performance, which is what a movie is all about, it's all about the performances and the story that you're telling with those performances, wouldn't have been as real, and it wouldn't have given you the same emotional scare that scene does give you.
It is scary.
I remember, you know, I was 9 years old when the movie came out, and that scared the living crap out of me.
Yeah, being strapped into a chair and being sort of slowly moved towards a terror dog in a fiery kitchen
at the time. But that was I was slightly prepubescent.
There's a bit of that going on.
There is the whole. Was it like the gatekeeper and the
keymaster and the gatekeeper?
Yeah, that wasn't phallic. I don't know what was. But yeah, I got to say, I think, as cringy as it was, Rick Moranis playing that accountant was hysterically
funny.
And
he came up with a lot of most of that dialogue is himself, you know, all that sort of stuff.
But how could they have improvised had they not had physical sets, as David says, if they had physical space to work in? And those guys, you know, and who is somebody else to say they could think of what would have more comic effect as a prop than, say, Bill Murray? Like, Bill Murray's choosing that. I mean, I don't know anyone who's, you know, infinitely funnier that should be given that job. I think if you've got comic talents like that, let them work the space, let them work the props, let them come up with the stuff, because, you know, that's what they're really good at.
Yeah, and you got a comic director as well, and they made sure they had a lot of time on set for all that sort of stuff, which I was just awesome.
Oh, time on set. Now, I thought Sigourney did I'm a big Sigourney fan.
Absolutely.
I think she's marvelous.
Her in that dress. She loved being in that dress, apparently.
Really?
She's just,
I liked her in
gorgeous,
everything.
Wonderful.
I even thought she was good in that one with Harrison Ford, with Melanie Griffiths. What was that? It's like
Working
95,
Girl?
But it wasn't. There
Working
you go.
Girl? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Sometimes I jump around in my underwear singing to my hairbrush. Doesn't make me Madonna. Never will. Best line. Anyway, yeah, I think she's great. I thought she was really good in this. And I think somebody commented that her sort of serious kind of acting cred, whatever, really elevated everybody else, because you need a couple of good sort of anchors, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always quite good to not have everybody goofing off. You'll have some good sort of serious people to fire off, like the guy from the EPA. It's sort of he is a sensationally great actor, and it's really good to have them as a, you know, you need the straight guy.
Well, Sig, who I've had the great pleasure of working with over the past couple of years, if you look at the movie, she's the only real character in the whole movie, and she's the voice of the audience in the movie, because you know all these strange things are happening to her, but every other character, from, you know, all of the Ghostbusters to Rick Moranis' character to the mayor to the police commissioner, everyone is a cartoon character. But you know, it's her, and then when she's put in danger and becomes slightly out of reality herself, that's when they have to bring in, you know, the fourth Ghostbuster, who's then, you know, the voice of reality. So, you know, she plays a very important story point, and she's fantastic in the movie. And as a 9-year-old boy watching that movie, yes, that dress was pretty damn amazing.
I'm telling you, her, Isabella Rossellini, just two absolutely superb actresses.
Absolutely. I'm with you there.
I find there's an intelligence to any performance that she gives, but it's kind of easy to be that straight.
It's interesting that you can put that one straight character in there, and all of a sudden it sort of justifies everybody else. It lets them you know, otherwise, if she was a character as well, it would sort of probably have gone in a completely different direction.
Well, David, you do a lot of comedic work in your spare time. And I mean, it's not an easy job to balance that absurd silly to absurd funny, is it?
It's absolutely not. And the reason why it works in this movie is because she explicitly points out that you're being absurd and weird.
You're a game show host.
Yeah, she's not playing along with it. Like, oh wow, you're wacky and crazy, and I guess all people are like this. She's like, you're very strange, and please get away from me. Mm. But that's what makes it funny, because he just keeps pushing it farther and farther and farther. But there's so many different styles of comedy in this movie, from your gross out humor, which I'm sure today it wouldn't be called Slimer, it'd be Farter or something like that, or Pooper or whatever. But you have the gross out humor, you have the really witty kind of highbrow intellectual wordplay comedy that Bill Murray is just fantastic with, and just pure physical farce comedy of people falling down and being covered in marshmallow and, the kind of absurdist stuff of a gigantic marshmallow man. It's just, there's not much bad you can say about this movie.
I guess the other thing that's pretty astounding if you think about it is that in terms of credits for coming up with stuff, obviously they were improvising, as we said, but Dan Aykroyd and of course Harold Ramis contributed enormously because of the writing, but yet they didn't really take the best stuff for themselves, because really, like, Dan Aykroyd doesn't have the funny laugh kind of max out that he could have got. I mean, I don't know the man personally, but it strikes me from seeing this work, he must have been very generous, as must have Harold Ramis, in the way they behaved on set, because, you know what I mean, like, they weren't playing it for laughs. They were providing a lot of shtick for somebody else to pull the punchline.
I think he gets off on the writing, and he really likes that sort of, when you look, he wrote all that, you know, trap is green, light is green, set your field, all that sort of stuff. He came up with all of that dialogue, and I think he's a real, when you hear him talk, I think he's quite unusual, really. I think he's that wonderful sort of dry writing style, and not so much the on camera.
I mean, I'll live until the day I die for the Blues Brothers, right? And therefore House of Blues. But and I think that it's good to see an ensemble cast where you can just kind of tell that there's must be a kind of generosity in terms of how they're working with each other, because it just comes off that way. It just doesn't look like they're stepping on each other.
Yeah, well, when they all went to Martha's Vineyard and locked themselves away for 3 weeks and wrote the thing and took it from the original sort of treatment to the script.
Who wrote that, or who went to it?
Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. Yeah.
Okay.
And Ivan, I guess, and they all sort of went and all just rented houses in Martha's Vineyard for about 3 weeks and just cracked out the script. And I think a lot of all of that sort of free roaming vapors and
really?
Phantasms, and that's a lot of Dan there. There's some very interesting dialogue.
That was what, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like very long to write.
They had the treatment, and they sort of basically said, "Oh, that's really funny. Great, $30 million, off you go." And they think, "Well, shit, we better have a script. Let's go and crank it out." And they had to write the script writing as they went along.
Have you tried doing collaborative writing like that, comic writing like that, David?
I have. I used to be part of a sketch comedy group here in LA called Acme Comedy Theater. Which we've produced a couple of people who are fairly well known, like Felicia Day and Will Wheaton. Well, Will came to the theater after he found fame earlier in his career. But one of the things they really stress there is collaborative comedy writing. And when you're doing that, you were saying, you know, it's generous to give the funny lines to someone else. No one remembers at the end of it who said what funny line. All they remember is that it was funny. And thereby by everyone in the movie is remembered as being funny. So if you know someone else can give you a great delivery on a line, you're going to give the line to them. You're going to give the line to whoever can make it work. There's a couple people who, I would write things specifically for them because of how well I knew they could deliver it. It's a collaborative comedy is actually fairly easier than solo comedy. because solo comedy, you can be sitting there writing away, you know, scene after scene, laughing to yourself, going, "This is the funniest thing I've ever written," and then you give it to someone else, and they just look at you, go, "I don't get it,"
or you read it yourself the next day.
Yes. So,
but yes, you know when you're like, when you've got someone who you just totally fire off and you can just sit there and you could just start with a blank sheet of paper and in just one day come up with something fantastic. So, I mean, I think what they're saying is the back half of the film, pretty much from when they are Ghostbusters, a lot of that is pretty much the script. But I think what Harold wanted to have is, let's set up that whole front story. Let's set up, how did they become Ghostbusters? How did they start this business? Which I think, for me, I love all of that sort of stuff. The getting the double mortgaging the house and the finding the firehouse and getting Ecto One and the car. And I think that's all. I love all that part of the movie. The setup.
Yeah. And giving who the people are who involved the writing of it, and their backgrounds. I'm sure a lot of it was a lot of kind of improvising around and just, you know, working out scenes interactively. Versus, you know, sitting down with a cork board and some index cards and plotting out, like, here's our A structure, here's our B structure, you know, okay, well, we have to break into two by page 25, and, you know, all that kind of stuff that screenwriters overanalyze and are over particular about. You know, I think they probably just improvised and improvised and improvised, and just whatever stuck and whatever worked, they kept, and then they just reworked it and they reworked it and they reworked it. And, I think if you look at the movie, you can see some of that in their scenes.
Yeah, because actually thinking about it now, it never struck me as one of those films where I knew where it was going and it was obvious that there was somebody that had to be saved. They're obviously going to get in and save them. It was obviously going to happen at just the right moment, blah, blah, blah. Because you weren't along for that ride. You were along for the ride of the kind of interaction, as you say, between the guys. Hey, let's talk about Richard Edlund for a second, because he was the visual effects supervisor and a superb talent, and did an enormous amount of huge work. He's still working. I think the last film he was on was Charlie Wilson's War, though he obviously mainly is known for his work with Boss Films and the stuff that they did. But really, he is one of the big sort of well-known figures of visual effects from the last, you know, sort of 20 years. I think he's won two Oscars, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really have liked his work, and I'd like to see more of his work. Have you come across him much in your stuff, David?
No, I've never worked with him. Obviously, I'm familiar with his work. A couple of the people who came out of Boss Films, like John Bruno, I'm working with now, but Richard, I've never actually worked with.
I think I'm right in saying the year that this came out, he was actually nominated for the Oscar. You know, that was like, I presume, 85, because the film came out in 84. But also, I think 2010 got an Oscar nom as well. But yeah, like, I think his body of work is terrific, and I'd love to see him more active. I should try and research where he's been doing stuff. I know he's done some stuff in Europe and stuff, and obviously he's still working, but
I guess he's more freelance now. He doesn't have a company, does he? Don't have the EEG or any of that.
What a spectacular set of, you know, skills and disciplines, I guess, that he's brought to, because he really did span that transition from the two states. And as you were saying, Jason, Multiplicity, which was near the end of the run of Boss Films, was a pretty friggin' complicated a film.
Oh, it's outstanding. It would have been a directing nightmare, but it's just so beautifully tied together. And obviously, Michael Keaton's performances just helped tie the whole thing together completely. But yeah, if you bother to think about it, it's absolutely astounding. There's not many scenes where there's not more lots of Michael in there.
Well, in finishing up, did we want to you know, summarize our kind of position on this film, starting with you, David?
I think I've said it many times, but, you know, I don't think anyone can look back at this film and not just treasure it, because it's fantastic. I'm fearing the day some really upstart, stupid comedian decides to try to remake it with all sorts of digital effects and everything like that. I'm sure someday, like everything I've grown to love, someone will come along and try to ruin it.
Son of Ghostbuster. What about you, Jason?
Please not. I mean, it's astounding. Definitely like top 20 film in my book. I think what I love about it most is that it's a really creative story. It's so different to every other film out there. It's such a unique concept, I think. You know, guys sort of all gathering together to bust ghosts. I think it's just the whole thing is brilliant.
Well, that pretty much finishes it up. I join you guys in agreeing it's a great film. I loved it to death. I must admit, I completely got the theme tune stuck in my head a second time in my life when I revisited it for this podcast, and for that's my only regret as far as the film goes, is to hum that senselessly while in the shower.
It's a great song.
But I must admit, I was one of those guys that when they first busted in to do that first trap, and they're all standing there in their uniforms, and I was like, yeah, I was practically cheering for them.
It is a big cheer moment.
It was a heroic New York film for me, and I thought it was terrific. And we thank you guys for being with us. So we also want to thank Pixel Core for doing the show, and particularly our producer, who is fond of saying here around the traps, back off, man, I'm a scientist. Until next time, David, thanks so much. I know you haven't updated your blog recently, but we have an expectation that you will soon.
I think most of my updates have been coming along on Twitter, which has been an amazing resource both for, talking with people and also getting a chance to help out people, which is something I really enjoy doing. So a couple of people have written me recently like, hey, have you, with the economy the way it is and facilities downsizing like they are, I've had a couple of people who have written me asking me if I have heard of any jobs that are coming up, and I've made a couple of connections for people and gotten people a couple of jobs. So, it's always nice to be able to do that. So hook me up on the Twitter, twitter.com/DavidStrupinis. And anyone who DMs me or @s me, I always reply to. So
you do. You're very good. And well, I hope if there'll be a few blog entries once you get out of NDA hell.
NDA hell will be continuing for a while, but hopefully sometime next year I'll be able to start talking about the amazing experience my life has been for the past 3 years.
And so. I think you may have touched on a possible trip down here.
Yes.
Well, we'll look forward to that one.
Excellent.
And I want to do a big shout-out to one of our regular hosts who has now publicly announced his engagement and forthcoming wedding, which is John. John Foss, congratulations from all of us here.
Excellent, yes.
John isn't with us this week.
Congratulations.
We like John a lot, and we know that he's going to enjoy married life. I like married life a lot. I think it's terrific.
It's fantastic. No other way.
Jason, where can people find you?
JasonWingrove.com is where I got the reel and stuff. One day I'll start a blog.
Okay.
Or Wingrove on Twitter.
And you can find me over at FX Guide, and my Twitter is Mike Seymour. Well, again, thanks so much.
And one last thing, we also have twitter.com/VFX show, which you can follow, and that'll let you know when new shows are posted.
That's true. We have a VFX show Twitter.
And obviously Mike and I also do another podcast called Red Center, all about red camera, the camera that's named after the color. Not the one you were mentioning, of course, Dave. Another one.
I actually quite enjoy doing Red Center because it's a geek out on cameras. It's fun. And I must admit, it's aspirational to me how much you get to shoot with stuff on set. So it is cool.
Well, this is sort of the reverse for me, I think.
Okay. Well, on that love fest note, we thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. See ya.